Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. This week is the final stretch for hundreds of bills that have passed the state legislature, awaiting their fate with Governor Gavin Newsom, with the stroke of a pen deciding whether to sign each into law or veto them. It's a time in state politics that comes with surprises. There are many headline-grabbing new state laws, but the vetoes can also get a fair share of attention. Among the bills stopped in its tracks is one that would have become a first-in-the-nation law, banning caste discrimination, which is a social hierarchy typically connected to South Asian countries like India and Nepal that determines a person's work and education opportunities from the day they are born. The bill raised awareness that this form of discrimination has filtered into powerful industries like Silicon Valley's tech sector. But the bill was also controversial within California's South Asian communities. Despite receiving overwhelming support from Democratic state lawmakers, Governor Newsom decided to block the bill from becoming law. We first talked about caste discrimination with CalMatters politics reporter Samia Kamal earlier this year. Samia joins us once again with why the bill came up short. Good morning, Samia.
Good morning, Vicky. Thanks for having me.
So I just skimmed the surface of what caste discrimination is. Dive into it more for those who are unfamiliar with what it is.
Sure. So it is a centuries-old social hierarchy system where you are kind of born into your caste, and that determines whether you can pursue educational opportunities, what kind of work that you do. It has a lot of social implications, you know, who you can marry. And it was banned in India, for example, back in 1950. But it's the legacy of it continues to play out in India, in South Asia, and here in the U.S. as the Asian community has grown.
And what I've learned from your reporting is the lowest caste, I mean, they can be called the untouchables. What does that mean?
Right. You know, there are sort of segregation measures where the lowest caste can't go to the same temples as the higher caste. You know, just there are things about using the same dishes. And, you know, there is a root in their religion. But some of these, I think, attributes have been maybe interpreted in a way that can be difficult for people, that creates, you know, more segregation and is especially hard to carry out in the U.S.
Yeah. And when I know it's predominantly in South Asian countries like India and Nepal, but also in terms of religions like Hindus and Sikhism, and even it expands to even those of Oaxacan descent, and that's in Mexico.
Right. You know, I think caste to some extent exists in a lot of communities, a lot of religions, and that's what's hard. You know, you may never root out those social caste behaviors, but I think what this bill tries to do is just ensure that it, or what it tried to do while it was still in play, was try to root that out, at least in housing and education and in employment issues where, you know, you can't use caste to, you know, prohibit someone from a particular type of job, from a pay raise, that kind of thing.
What did you learn about how caste discrimination has filtered into California?
So I think we've seen the most impact of it in the tech sector because it's such a large, you know, South Asian community. I believe something like 25% of the workers in Santa Clara and San Mateo counties are, come from India, those with bachelor's degrees who work in the tech sector. And so, you know, I think we hear a lot about there's a social division, but also, you know, who has the opportunity. And some of that is traced to the immigration patterns because, you know, people with access to education in India were able to get to the U.S. earlier than, you know, those from lower castes. That kind of created a different class system here where people from lower castes, when they came here, they didn't have the same opportunities. Maybe they came later in life, you know, didn't have the same educational opportunities. So they maybe couldn't get the same jobs that people from upper castes in India could get here in the U.S.
And maybe by the time that they were able to immigrate over to California and to the Silicon Valley and the example you're using, it impacted their upward mobility within a company.
Exactly. Yeah.
Given that there's already a range of discrimination laws in California from, you know, race and ethnicity to gender, sexual orientation, housing, education, employment, why was this bill needed?
that was the big question, I think, throughout the bill process is, what is caste included under ancestry? And so there is a case at Cisco that both sides point to, a couple of years ago, an employee filed a complaint alleging that he was denied a pay raise and experienced some harassment due to his caste. And so the state civil rights department brought a case against the company. That lawsuit is still ongoing. And so opponents of the bill pointed to that case as, you know, well, it's already covered, so why do we need an additional bill? But supporters point to that case as, well, caste discrimination is happening, as you can see from this case. So, you know, maybe we need to make it more explicit. And, you know, I think there is a sense of wanting to shift the burden of, trying to prove whether caste is covered to the state and not on individuals.
And there was also like a strong opposition within South Asian communities in California, which are very diverse. They're far from a monolith, right? And you covered this extensively. Why did this become such a divisive issue among South Asian communities?
I think there were a couple of things going on. I spent some time out at the Capitol where I got to talk to both supporters and opponents. And there was, you know, a fear that this bill would somehow allow the state to determine people's caste or to, you know, ask them for that information and, you know, log it somewhere. So kind of a fear of people's religions being used against them or just assuming that they were discriminating because maybe they were from an upper caste. I think some of the outrage over this bill, you know, it got attention as far as India, you know, newspapers and TV stations were talking and writing about this bill out there. And so it was, you know, you were hearing a lot of voices and it was, you know, at times I think tricky to tell who was coming from California and the many, many interested parties from around the nation, around the globe. And it's also the first bill of its kind on the state level. I think we saw a bill in the city of Seattle that passed as well as in Fresno just, you know, weeks ago. But on the state level, California would have been the first. And, you know, as it is, California, what we do tends to attract some attention, but this bill especially.
That's interesting. I mean, you mentioned that India banned caste discrimination, I think, back in the 1950s, correct? But it even is gaining interest in India, you know, the fact that California considered this law. What does that signal? Like, what is that? I mean, that I find that so interesting. It like crossed, it went to the other side of the world. And so about caste discrimination.
Yeah,
and I guess how prevalent it still is.
Right. Yeah. I think informally it is still prevalent. And there's also, you know, the geopolitical situation in India. Otherwise, there is a strong Hindu nationalist movement and that is separate from caste, but they do end up intersecting a bit. And one of the common threads is a message about the fear of Hindu phobia. And, if some of the issues with the earlier versions of the bill, it did describe, you know, South Asians and called out some South Asian countries. And so there was a fear that, well, if you specifically identify this group of people as being perpetrators of caste discrimination, that could lead to more Hindu phobia. So in later versions of the bill, that language was amended out. But it's a couple of conversations happening at once.
Yeah. Well, despite the contentiousness of this bill, when you look at the votes, it overwhelmingly passed both the state assembly and the state senate. So why did the governor block a bill from really his own party?
Yeah, that is the big question that a lot of people are asking. And, you know, his reason was because he said the bill was unnecessary given the state's existing laws. And so, you know, going back to that Cisco case. But it does further fuel speculation that maybe he has ambitions for higher office, for the presidency someday. And, you know, some of that speculation is, well, maybe he doesn't want to alienate certain groups. And just in late September, the census published some data about Asian Indians being the fastest growing group in the U.S. And that is a huge population that maybe you don't want to alienate. And I think people are also, there's this bill and there's a few other vetoes that the governor has issued that, you know, people are kind of looking at them in a trend of, what is the governor's goal here? But, you know, in some senses, the governor has also been known to be more moderate when it comes to bills that impact business. And so this could be, you know, also just more along that pattern of his support of tech companies and their ability to, you know, operate the way they want to.
Yeah. And Republican lawmakers were at least voiced their opposition to this bill as well. Was that in line with their opposition that it could impact the business sector?
That was one of the arguments, yes, along with whether it was necessary, that it might be too divisive. But yes, also the impact on the economy and California's ability to innovate.
Leading up to this decision, this veto, there was a hunger strike and in support of caste discrimination becoming a new state law. What did you learn from people that were partaking in this? Because it lasted for 30 days. And is it still continuing?
I don't actually know the status. I know that the one of the groups that was leading it has issued a statement that they are still optimistic for the future. I think I, you know, just judging by the bill analysis, the number of groups that were in support of the bill, there were a lot of civil rights groups, a lot of, you know, legal groups, different lawyers associations. And I think to some extent it was, you know, maybe it wasn't a complete failure because they did get to educate a lot of people. And that's something that Senator Aisha Wahab, the author of the bill, did say is a lot of her work on this bill was just educating people, other lawmakers, about what caste is and, you know, just people's complete unfamiliarity with the issue. And that could have, you know, determined the outcome as well. Even during the legislative process, there were moments where it was not certain that the bill would get through. And it was even within other Democratic legislators who asked this, you know, for the bill to be paused so they could study it further. So, I think I learned that the supporters were doing a lot of education and awareness. And, you know, I don't know that this will be the end of that.
Why is it such a politically tricky issue?
I think that when the bill, you know, calls out discrimination and even if it's not written in the language that, you know, it's more likely to come from a certain group, that idea of potentially, you know, sort of the reverse discrimination of, well, this group will be the ones to perpetrate this. That, I think, is something lawmakers did not really want to be responsible for or to further. And so they did work on the bill language to try and fix that. And so in the end, you know, I think that was why they passed it. They got to a place where they were comfortable with how the language was, including making caste a subset of ancestry. But yeah, we did see some examples. For example, Assemblymember Ash Kalra, he is the first South Asian lawmaker in the legislature, and he didn't actually comment on the bill until very late in the process. And when he did, it was actually a very, you know, emotional comment. He had tears in his eyes, and he was talking about how difficult it is to sort of see the division among the community. We also saw at the federal level Congressman Ro Khanna, who, you know, initially he did support the bill, but later he did backtrack his comments a little bit. I think, again, going back to maybe one of possibly the governor's reasons for vetoing is just not wanting to isolate or alienate communities.
Is there another avenue outside of state legislation?
I think the other route would be to make the language in the civil rights department's maybe, you know, guidance more clear. But I'm not sure if that would also require a move from the legislature. But yeah, the state agency route would be perhaps another avenue where that law already exists and, you know, how to strengthen that.
Did the author of the bill, did they discuss potentially reintroducing it, having a second version next year?
Senator Wahab has not committed to a second version. What she said was she does think that the language around caste discrimination does need to be more explicit. She said that she'll continue fighting, but we don't know yet what that looks like.
As we close our conversation, Samia, you mentioned that local governments are passing caste discrimination laws, including Fresno. Fresno became the second city in the country. Why Fresno? I mean, we're talking about the Silicon Valley. Why was Fresno in California the first city to pass a law like this.
Yeah, California has a very rich history of South Asians, especially the Sikh population, who came to Stockton, you know, around 1912. That's when the first Sikh temple, the Gurdwara, was established. And so there is a strong community and, you know, a deeply rooted community. And so I think just the ability to organize politically was one factor. But they also got alliance from the Oaxacan community. And so that, you know, I think those factors combined helped the city pass that. I think something like this maybe could be easier to pass on the city level in some senses, although we did see in Cupertino just, you know, whether the city was, when the city was deciding whether to support this bill or not, SB 403, they had, you know, an hours long discussion at the end. They couldn't really come to an agreement. So, you know, I think that makes Fresno's ability to pass the resolution, you know, more significant. Mm.
Samia, thank you. Thank you for the update. Samia Kamal is a politics reporter with CalMatters, updating us on a caste discrimination bill that would have become the first state law of its kind in the country, but it was vetoed by Governor Gavin Newsom. Up next, in Placer County, a murder sentence has made history in California. It is the first murder conviction for a fentanyl-related death in the state. We'll revisit a conversation I had with Placer County's district attorney about the precedent that this sets. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Yesterday, a murder sentence in Placer County made history. In California, a 22-year-old man was sentenced to 15 years to life in prison after pleading guilty to second-degree murder for selling drugs laced with fentanyl that led to the death of a 15-year-old girl in Roseville. It is the first-ever murder conviction in the state for a fentanyl-related death. The girl's family spoke to reporters following the sentencing yesterday. Her mother said while she can never get her daughter back, she finds comfort that her tragic death was key in setting a new legal precedent. This summer, I spoke with the Placer County District Attorney about this historic case. DA Morgan Geyer explained how this is a model for other prosecutors in Northern California and around the state. You made the fentanyl crisis a top priority when you took office back in 2020. Why was this issue specifically so important to you?
Lots of factors. We were thrust into the crisis in 2020. We were in the middle of a global pandemic. The world was shut down. And our county, not unique to other communities, was seeing an alarming rate of particularly teenagers and young adults dying from fentanyl. They were probably engaging in risk-taking behavior more than they were probably prone to, given the circumstances of the pandemic. We had seniors in high school missing life-defining moments, people who were already prone to depression because of isolation and things like that were exacerbated, and we, as a team, just sort of realized we had to do more.
We've had this conversation on Insight multiple times over the last couple of years, and unfortunately, it's just continued to grow and evolve in the wrong direction in California. I remember in 2021 talking to parents who lost a child from fentanyl poisoning, and they do emphasize poisoning because these counterfeit pills are unknowingly laced with fentanyl. Can you explain for listeners that distinction between overdosing and poisoning?
Absolutely. And that was a steep learning curve for me during this fentanyl crisis. And it began with what became sort of a high profile case in our community. It was a high school senior named Zach Didier who had died from fentanyl poisoning. And it was in my discussions with his family as we were reviewing the case. We sadly had other cases we were reviewing to figure out this ultimate question of how and should you hold someone responsible for selling something that is dangerous to someone else. And in this discussion, these parents who had never really heard of what fentanyl was before until the coroner told them that was the cause of their son's death had said he was poisoned. And we sort of had this very marked discussion about it. And it was very enlightening to me. And it was illustrating that there are two separate fronts of this fentanyl crisis that we are fighting. There are those who are battling addiction, those who are seeking fentanyl. And unfortunately, with the lethality of the fentanyl that's in today's market, we are losing those people more rapidly. Usually drug addiction, if it goes untreated, will cost you your life, but after a long, prolonged battle. This aspect of fentanyl, the poisoning aspect of it, was completely different. These were people who were being deceived, and they took something that they thought was something else. And the sort of example that I have used, because I heard from some of these parents, were if I walked into a bar and ordered a shot of whiskey, and someone poured me a shot of cyanide and I drank it, no one would say I overdosed on cyanide. They would say you were poisoned. You took something that you thought was something else. You were deceived, and it cost you your life. And it became clear that there's a difference. And there's also, I think, a social difference a little bit in how we describe the problem. And part of that, and it's a difficult line to draw, because there is some shame involved in the taking of those substances because it's something somebody shouldn't have done. And so calling it an overdose sort of has societal implications. Not that those are not worthy of treating, not that those aren't worthy of fighting, but it's a different situation. And I think the way we try and proactively fight this fight, we need to be precise with our vocabulary. And that was very, very informative to me to have that conversation.
And in that time, fentanyl deaths have skyrocketed across the state. In Placer County, data from the county shows a 450% increase in fentanyl deaths between 2019 and 2021. One piece of responding to this is criminal justice and holding those responsible accountable. What are the challenges and kind of the nuances with achieving that goal when it comes specifically to fentanyl?
Yeah, and I appreciate the intro there. It is one piece of an overall campaign in this fentanyl crisis. It is critically important. This fentanyl crisis is not, it's not just a public health issue, and it's not just a public safety or criminal justice issue. It's a combination of all of those things. So when it comes to the criminal justice aspect, it hadn't been done before. The idea that we're punishing drug dealers for selling drugs that are ultimately harmful, that's been done forever, and we have debated how best to handle those who are selling drugs. But fentanyl changed the landscape. Its accessibility, its lethality, the deception around it was costing lives right and left. And so this question became, how do we appropriately identify those who need to be held accountable versus those who might be in need of treatment because they themselves are addicts? And it's a very fine line on how we draw that distinction. But what we do is we are guided by the evidence of any particular investigation. Is someone's motive for selling profit? And if it is motivated by profit, are they aware of the risks? And how can we determine and ultimately demonstrate to a jury, if we choose to charge, what the evidence is that separates someone who is motivated by this deadly profit as opposed to someone who is struggling to feed their own addiction? And it's incumbent upon prosecutors to identify those differences. But that's sort of the hallmarks of determining whether or not someone is deserving of criminal prosecution, and then if they are, whether or not that ultimately results in a murder charge or something legally less than that.
The reason why we're talking to you is because your office secured a second-degree murder conviction of a fentanyl dealer. That is the first of its kind in California. Given that fentanyl is a crisis that spans and transcends California across the country, in this state specifically, why is this conviction so rare? Why is Placer County the first?
We have a limited amount of criminal liability statutes that can hold someone accountable for the act of selling something that ends up being deadly. So we have, on the low end of causing someone's death, we have involuntary manslaughter, which is punished not real significantly, and under California law, someone who causes the death of someone else through recklessness or negligence, you have that on the one sort of side of the spectrum. And on the other end, we have murder, which obviously is the most extreme punishment that we can ask for in criminal law as it relates to the death of someone. The real question for prosecutors is, and I teach courses to law enforcement and to students, and I always say when it comes to being a prosecutor, there's the debate of can you do something, and then there's the more complicated debate of should you do something. And that's why I think, given the number of deaths we've had in our county, we've seen a very small percentage of those investigations result in the filing of criminal charges. And that's because either we can't prove it, or in those situations that we can, the question, should we, is answered in the negative.
The case that resulted in this conviction involved the fentanyl death of a 15-year-old girl from Roseville. The man who was convicted is Nathaniel Kabakungun. Can you tell us more about this case and what stood out to you about this case?
Generally, in these kinds of cases, what we look for is sort of what I mentioned earlier is, are there those hallmarks of knowledge about the danger of what the substance is? Is there that sort of profit motivation? Is there what we refer to as sort of a deadly ambivalence, that appreciation of a risk and a disregarding of that risk, saying, I don't care. I know what I'm doing is dangerous and deadly, but I'm going to engage in this behavior anyway. And when we can answer those questions as a yes, it clearly moves the needle towards some sort of criminal prosecution, and in these cases, murder, when the evidence that underlies someone's knowledge of how dangerous their behavior is overwhelming and can obviously be proven beyond a reasonable doubt.
You mentioned Zachary Didier, and that was a 17-year-old Rockland teen who died in 2020 due to fentanyl poisoning. In the courtroom for this second-degree murder conviction was his parents. And in his case specifically, that suspect pled guilty in 2022, sentenced to 17 years for involuntary manslaughter in addition to other charges. How did this case lay the framework for this second-degree murder conviction?
The Bordner case, the case in which Zach Didier was killed, was our first one. It was the first one in our county. It was one of the relatively first ones to be in the COVID era of a fentanyl poisoning. And we had to navigate by looking around throughout the state of how other offices were handling it. We obviously know our theories of liability and we know what our options were, but nothing really had reached the goal line yet on the murder aspect of it. So we were going through the investigation to try and determine how do we hold the person, should we hold this person responsible, and if so, how. Clearly, the selling of deadly fentanyl to someone is at a very minimum negligent, reckless, and is the basis for an involuntary manslaughter charge. But as we were making our way through Zach's case, we kept having more and more teenagers and young adults dying. And unfortunately, they all usually typically start as a coroner case where there's a medical emergency. And it's not seen as a crime scene. It's not seen necessarily as something that might lead to criminal punishment when someone has a medical emergency that requires first responders to come in and either transport them or attempt CPR. So our ability to gauge and analyze these investigations sadly got better through it happening more and more.
Now, since your conviction in July, there are two other Northern California district attorneys who have filed murder charges in fentanyl deaths. One is in Sutter County and the other by Sacramento County District Attorney Tian Ho, who you worked with during your 15 years in the Sacramento County DA's office. Is there collaboration or even communication among district attorneys since you all are grappling with the same crisis?
There are. And fortunately, especially the Northern California district attorneys communicate frequently. We have sort of regional meetings. This has been one of the most significant issues affecting our offices for the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. So most have already done the analysis of whether or not they would be willing, under the right circumstances, to file these kinds of cases, and really just waiting for those facts to present themselves. Not waiting as in, I can't wait and I'm hoping, but with that dread of, at some point, we're going to find an investigation with a set of facts that are going to deserve, in our opinion, the filing of murder charges. So we're all familiar with the law. It's really just a sharing of investigative tactics because these are relatively new investigations. And how do you piece together the final moments of someone's life as they interact with the individual who sold them the deadly fentanyl? So we trade tactics and tips in that respect. But I think the fundamental question of whether or not Murder charges should be filed in these circumstances. Ultimately rests with the discretion of the elected DA of that particular county, and you've seen those that are willing to do so, and you may see more in the future, or you may hear from some that say, I don't think this is ever appropriate.
And your office currently has filed other murder charges against other suspected fentanyl dealers, correct?
We have, yes. We have two others currently pending.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and we've been speaking with Placer County District Attorney Morgan Geyer, who secured the first murder conviction against a fentanyl dealer in California. Earlier this year, the California legislature, they debated how to address the fentanyl crisis, and that led to emotional testimony during committee hearings. The central debate among lawmakers, and really I think the general public as well, was whether to combat this crisis through public safety and tougher punishments or focus more on education and prevention. What stands out to you about this debate?
What stands out remarkably is that I think our legislature did a very good job in responding to the public health aspect of the fentanyl crisis. And I was a little, frankly, disappointed in the response and their actions as it relates to public safety. This is not a unilateral situation that requires only a certain kind of approach. We need all tools available. I am very cognizant of the concern and fear about sort of reinvigorating the failed war on drugs, and that is oftentimes what is said in response to prosecutors who are seeking to be aggressive to those who are selling deadly fentanyl. But we need to be able to attack both the education outreach and prevention side to reduce demand, but we also need to be able to aggressively hold people accountable who know exactly what they're doing. And that falls on the district attorney to be able to do that, and we need flexibility and a number of different tools so that our only option isn't a murder charge when we wouldn't want one to be there.
Mm. When it comes to the war on drugs, you know, opponents who, you know, don't want harsher penalties for the fentanyl cases, you know, they argue that during the country's crack epidemic, it inevitably created harmful consequences for underserved communities, communities of color, and these communities that still can be felt very much today. What is your response to those concerns, especially when striking the right balance, as you're talking about, striking that right balance between public safety with prevention and treatment?
It's an excellent question, and I would start off by pointing out that the victims of this fentanyl crisis are overwhelmingly people of color and disadvantaged communities, and they are being ravaged by this illicit and deadly fentanyl. Striking that balance is key, and there were a lot of lessons learned, I think, from what we consider the war on drugs from the 80s and 90s that were had very punitive measures towards people who were battling addiction, people who were perhaps selling to feed that addiction. And I think fentanyl, while the profit motivation for selling drugs hasn't changed, that's the same motivation that has been present as long as we've been living together as a society. This is different. Fentanyl has changed the landscape. The lethality of it is unbelievable. And we are starting to become aware of that intimately. Everyone is starting to aware. You can't become aware. You can't travel around our communities in Sacramento County, Placer County, all of our surrounding counties without seeing warnings, without seeing billboards, without having heard of these stories. And the idea that someone can take a small amount of this and die on their first occasion, and a dealer very well may know that, is what sort of lends to the idea that we need to be holding dealers more accountable. But finding that balance is absolutely critical. Unfortunately, well, I say fortunately, district attorneys are charged with that amount of discretion, and there's no way to craft a law that prevents us from exercising discretion and having any sort of ability to hold someone accountable. Because whether we like it or not, there are those who know exactly what they're doing, and they're poisoning people, and they're making a profit on it, and that's more important than the health and safety of their customers.
Given that you've been dissatisfied with the public safety aspect of legislation that's making its way through the Capitol, which would, you know, I think in your view, make your job easier and other district attorneys' jobs easier when it comes to having penalties against fentanyl dealers, you know, is what you're doing now by securing the first murder conviction in California when it came to a fentanyl death, is this kind of finding a way around legislation as these bills are kind of in limbo and they're moving through the state capitol?
I would never file a murder charge simply because I don't have any other alternative. The facts and circumstances of a case justify a murder charge or they don't. I would like some other flexibility because while those cases are going to be rare and represent a very small number, there are other situations where a murder charge would not be appropriate, but my ability to hold someone accountable may be not enough, frankly. And there, we don't have a lot of flexibility on that aspect. There are dealers of all different varieties and up and down the food chain in this hierarchy of drug dealers. There are high quantity dealers who are selling hundreds or thousands of pills at a time that could be lethal to an entire community. There are those street level dealers who are selling 5 to 10 pills at a time. Those are the ones we see killing people in our community more often, because that's the direct interface that our users have, or our victims that are purchasing these. So I would like to see a little bit more flexibility and just a few more tools in our toolbox, so to speak, to be able to hold those dealers accountable. But again, the murder charges are going to be there based on their own merits, and not simply because, well, everything else is too lenient, therefore I'm going to charge something for murder that otherwise wouldn't independently. We're not going to be doing that, and I trust no other district attorney would feel that way either. But there is room to have more flexibility in our criminal law.
Finally, you're born and raised in Placer County, and now you're the Placer County District Attorney. You have been for the last couple of years. What makes you optimistic that, you know, we're at, or hopefully soon, at a turning point in this crisis?
While the focus of most of my conversations lately have been on the criminal justice aspect of it, my hope comes from our outreach efforts. Placer County, like we discussed, we had tackled that early on. We had reached every high school student. By last year, every high school student had attended an assembly. We had talked to parents. We've had conversations in the community about signs, sort of new signs, not just automatic self-isolation or failing school, the classic hallmark signs of a kid who is struggling. But we've seen kids who are straight-A students who are dying of fentanyl. And that has caused families to have conversations that they otherwise wouldn't have had about how are you feeling and what sort of pressures are you under. And through those conversations, I know that we're saving lives. It's always hard to calculate how many lives you've saved through this, but through the conversations our communities are having throughout our region, I know that it's having an impact. The numbers, at least for 2023 that we've seen, tend to show that the youth, the teenagers and young adults, those numbers are reducing. We will still have those who are dying from fentanyl of all ages, but it seems to be the average age seems to be trending upward, which means those outreach efforts are hopefully finding their target audience, which is the teenagers and young adults. So I'm optimistic that through those efforts, combined with our public safety efforts, we're making a difference in saving lives.
District Attorney Geyer, thank you for the time.
Thank you so much for having this conversation with me. I really appreciate it.
And that is Placer County District Attorney Morgan Geyer discussing obtaining the first ever murder conviction for a fentanyl-related death in California and how it sets a precedent for other prosecutors in Northern California and around the state. 22-year-old Nathaniel Cabacangun was sentenced yesterday for the murder of a 15-year-old girl from Roseville. Our conversation with the DA first aired in August. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Schlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Sacramento has long had a love affair with the arts, whether visual, theatrical, musical, literary, culinary, the list goes on and on. We even dedicate the second Saturday in Midtown during the warmer months to stroll around and take in the art our city has to offer. But since the onset of the pandemic, the art scene in Sacramento has suffered a lot. Galleries closing, artists moving out of town in search of success in bigger cities like San Francisco and Los Angeles. All the while, smaller galleries, curators, and local artists still struggle to stay afloat and share their stories through their work. One such artist and gallery curator is Faith J. McKinney. After a year and a half hiatus, the Faith J. McKinney Gallery has reopened in the heart of Midtown, celebrating the work of underrepresented and marginalized local artists. Faith McKinney joins us now with her perspective on the Sacramento art scene and what needs to be done to keep it thriving here in the capital city. Good morning, Faith.
Good morning, Vicki.
So you are I'm doing wonderful. It's always nice to talk to you, Faith. You are a well-known art entrepreneur and curator here in Sacramento. Let's start off with your roots here in Sacramento.
Yeah, so I was raised in Sacramento. I moved here from Alabama when I was 2 months old. So I like to say that I'm born and raised here in South Sac. Went to high school, graduated high school here, and then left. And I recently came back about 10 years ago and really wanted to get involved with the art. So I started working at Crocker Art Museum, Sojourner Truth African Heritage Museum, Bigger Than Us Art, Sacramento Theater Company, and really immersing myself in the art scene in the last few years in Sacramento.
How has the art scene in Sacramento grown and evolved in the time that you've been part of it?
Gosh, it's definitely expanded as far as space. There's some really amazing spaces. And as we talk about these non-traditional art spaces that we need in our city, I've seen a growth of those spaces, people turning their garage into art exhibition spaces like the Garage on the Grove in North Sacramento or the Inside Out Gallery on 21st and I, this alternative space that's an art window that you can't walk in, but there's some really amazing installations happening. So I've definitely seen the growth, but unfortunately in the last 3 years, we've also seen, you know, a dearth of spaces to view art and a profusion of abandoned and vacant spaces. And so I think a lot of my work is reclaiming those spaces for transformative art experiences. And that's working with Art and Mall and taking over an abandoned the old Gap in Art and Mall and turning that into a gallery, an exhibition titled Black Creativity at the Heart of Sacramento. Or I did a project last year called Coordinates Ice Pack, which was taking over the Sutter Capital Group building that was set to be demolished. So I, you know, did a gallery and then I did an exhibition, a very immersive exhibition with 35 local Sacramento-based artists. And so there's this moment of a lot of my work is going into these spaces and reclaiming them. I grew up in museums, so I know what art can do for people. And I think that's what, especially in the last 3 years, really using artists to kind of to share ideas and think about, you know, a path forward through.
I went to one. One was behind the ice blocks, you know, off our street in Midtown.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that was. So it started as my gallery. So the amazing Sutter Capital Group, which are developers in Sacramento, they are also patrons of the arts and collectors. And they reached out to me. They loved the work that I did. They collected some work from me and they offered the space. And they said, you know, it's abandoned. There's nothing going on in here. What can you do? So I originally proposed a gallery. So I had 5 exhibitions featuring Black, queer, women artists. And then I knew it was going to get demolished. And right now they're you know, pretty well into the build of a new residential building. And so I knew it was going to get demolished. So if you're familiar with Meow Wolf, which is a very immersive art or Art Hotel and Art Street, which we've had in our own city. And I thought about, okay, this building's going to get torn down. How can we use this space? And it was titled Coordinates. And if you remember, it had the coordinates across the building because I really want to speak of what was here before and what's coming after. And I think as we have this really, when you look around, especially downtown and Midtown, we see a lot of growth. And I'm always thinking about, okay, who and what was displaced? And what will be here before, and especially working with artists, and we think about space, affordable housing for artists, and a lot of this housing that's going up, artists can't afford. So there's really this conversation on how artists can take over space, and really transform how we as our community and the creative economy. I like to say that coordinate space generated a lot of income for Hook and Ladder and for Beast and Bounty and for West Elm. A lot of people shop, you know, when you go out and, you know, go to an experience, you're going to shop, you're going to eat afterwards. So there's this moment that, you know, our community is benefiting from art and taking over these spaces.
Yeah, I mean, you were talking about creativity, obviously, because we're talking about galleries and art, and people seem to think, or, you know, obviously think about, you know, the pieces that you take in, but you're being creative in the spaces that you're searching for. You're finding vacant buildings or buildings that are going to be demolished, even your space now. It was an old, it was formerly like a Starbucks, right?
Yes, yes, yeah. So it was a Starbucks that I frequented. It was on 16th Street, so 1020 16th Street, and they closed in 2020 during the pandemic. So for 3 years, that space has been empty, and we it has beautiful windows. So everyone walks by it. If you go to Makuni's, if you go to Pyology, you're walking by it. You're also walking by P.F. Chang's, which has been empty since 2020, since the beginning of the pandemic. And so Mark Friedman and Mike Heller, who have Fulcrum Properties and Heller Pacific, respectively, they're both developers in the city. They own that building. And they said, hey, this building is sitting here. What would you like to do? And along with my practice coming into these spaces and reclaiming and bringing artists, I'm actually currently on the second exhibition. And for me, this space is a bit different. It is a gallery, but it's also a project space. And it's a space where artists can be very experimental. And I don't want it necessarily, I think, since we're losing commercial galleries, and there's a whole nother conversation about patronage in the arts and people collecting and actually acquiring work from galleries and artists that keep the gallery ecosystem sustained. But I wanted this to be a place where artists can come and maybe bring that really large sculpture out of the back of their studio and put it up with beautiful lighting and a window facing 16th Street, which is a major corridor, and really open up the art to our city and to the community.
Yeah. I mean, I think of it like when in parts of Midtown and downtown, like there's these beautiful murals as well. Like it's wonderful to be surrounded by art, and it attracts you to downtown and Midtown, which contributes more broadly to the local economy and businesses
Absolutely.
That are there.
Yes.
You, the vision for your gallery is a project space for curatorial intervention. What does that mean?
Yeah, so as a curator, I'm not an artist, but I'm engaging with artists. So I get to engage, I get to create conversation between artists and between objects. So this is really a space for me to learn, and not necessarily, again, not this commercial gallery where I'm placing something on the wall and it has to sell and I really need to sell. This is a space where the current show, Beth Consetta Rubel, who is a Black woman artist and based in Sacramento, and a lot of her work is speaking on colorism and close to whiteness privilege. And there's this conversation we're constantly having in our society. And I want that to happen in this space. And that, for me, that's that curatorial intervention. And it may not sell, it may not be commercial, but there's still a conversation. There's a lot of education happening for me and for viewers.
And what I'm learning from you is this curatorial intervention that you're doing, because there's so many intersections. It also includes, you know, necessary partnerships with the business community as well for these spaces.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Like I said, Fulcrum Properties and Heller Pacific and Setter Capital, I wouldn't be able to do this work without them, because they're operating in the built environment. And that's not a place that I have equity, and that's not a place where I have leadership. But I do in the arts community. So there's definitely this collaboration and partnership. And even with patrons, I think there's people that will just write a check. You know, there's still so much money that goes into something like this. And I do have those patrons that say, hey, we believe in what you do. We love to experience it. This is how, you know, this is how we can support you. And that's really important, because artists, we have a great community of artists in Sacramento, and they're doing amazing work. But sometimes it happens in silos, and not everyone gets to see it. You know, we're not doing this. We have, you know, SAC Open Studios, where you get to go into the studios for maybe 2 weekends of the year. But a lot of artists here are doing amazing things that galleries and art, alternative art spaces and museums really need to highlight and provide visibility to that work.
And we're talking,
that's what I hope to hear.
And we're talking about this. I mean, you laid this out. The last 3 years have just been brutal for the local art scene. And you are intimately connected with local artists in Sacramento. What would you say the state of local arts in Sacramento, where it stands today?
Yes, I think that we're still struggling. I think artists, curators, institutions, spaces, we're still struggling for funds. I think there's a conversation that we need to have with the city and think about the funding for the creative economy. I think that Megan Van Voorhees and her team with Office of Arts and Culture has done amazing work, and I've actually benefited from some grants. But we also need we need patrons. You know, we need supporters. We need businesses, and we need space. I think right now we have so much space, and I think of K Street downtown. When I walk down K Street, there's block after block of just empty space and abandoned and vacant, and artists can go in there and transform that. And it can help their practice. It can help our community. There can be some actual community engagement and this discussion around arts and how it transforms our community, rather than it sitting empty that and is not being used by artists or the community.
Faith, thank you so much. I'm here for that.
Yes.
Faith McKinney is the curator of the FJM Gallery in Midtown Sacramento. It is on 16th Street. You can find out more about Faith, her gallery, and her work at capradio.org/insight. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Have a great day. We'll catch you here tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.